This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, So You Want to Be a Writer, celebrating 100 episodes of Dissecting Dragons.
Woo!
I'm so excited about this episode.
Yeah, me too. I can't believe it. I know. 100 episodes.
What's even more unbelievable, people are still listening.
I know, right? Why would anyone want to listen to a bunch of nerds like us? So I guess the first thing we should start off with is just to say an enormous thank you to everyone who's stuck with us so far, who's still engaged with the nonsense that we're spouting. And yeah, just thank you for making this possible.
Yeah, and thank you for sharing us with your friends in a non-weird way. That sentence ended up in a place I didn't anticipate. Basically, thank you for sharing our podcast with your friends. Please keep doing that. Don't share us personally with your friends. I'm going to stop there.
Yeah, it's a good idea, Jules. So for this episode, we thought we'd take a look back and we'd sort of go back to the beginning, not just of Dissecting Dragons, but back to the origins, our origin stories as writers. And we thought we'd just talk about writing. The ins and outs of it, our personal journeys, the beginning of Dissecting Dragons, and the way that we've developed over time.
Yeah. And, well, as writers, we're quite interested in writers' journeys generally, but we don't often really talk about our own, so...
So I guess that we should start. I'm going to ask you a question, Jules.
Okay.
How old were you when you wrote your first story?
About 8, I think.
And how long was it?
Oh, about 9 pages. But, you know, there were a lot of pictures on those pages as well. It illustrated my own book. It had no plot, it had no characterization. Yeah.
But that's where it began.
That's where it began.
And did you show it to anybody?
Yes, I did. I come from quite a bookish family, so the lack of plot and characterization were really kind of against me there.
You received personal critical feedback.
No, it was always like, oh, no, it's lovely, well done, darling. But the trouble was I was an extremely perceptive child, so I could tell that that wasn't really what they thought. Weirdly, that made me go away and try harder. And then I went up another year in school, and... We actually started doing creative writing when I turned 9. It was a very short little story, and I used to get really good marks at that because I was quite imaginative.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think I've still got the folder somewhere, and they're dreadful. They're really bad. I mean, they're not bad for a 9-year-old, but they're really bad. And I think I loved doing that so much, and it just sort of went on from there. But as time went on, I stopped wanting to show my work to people.
Yes. You became a closet writer.
I did become a closet writer for about 20 years. But apparently I wasn't as firmly in the closet as I thought I was. Everyone knew what I was up in my room doing. So there you go. What about you?
Well, I think... the first story I remember physically writing and completing, I did when I was, I must have been 7, 8 maybe.
Yeah.
And it was a total ripoff of another story that I'd read. Almost an exact ripoff of the plot. I wrote it in my own words, obviously. Yeah. The original version was significantly better, but that was the first piece of writing that I ever did. The first sort of story, and it was about a wand or something like that. It was about getting a wand and you could change things and do all sorts of magic, but then things got very much out of hand. So the main character does a reversal spell to put everything back to normal, and it ends with the line, "But now they, but now I need to explain to my teacher why my desk is a tree," something like that. So yeah, I basically just took that concept and sort of played around with it a little bit. The first time I wrote a book, I must have been 9. A little book, and again, it was the same thing. 9 years old, we did creative writing as part of a school project in English, and we would write these stories and put them and print them and draw pictures and stuff like that. And I got a little award for mine because it was utterly ridiculous and very colourful and stuff. I think for me, however, because writing was such a problem, physically writing, most of the stories I told were just in my head. And I'd memorize them and I'd tell oral tales instead.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I was older that I actually kind of realized that being a writer was actually a genuine thing. You know, I was writing stories just so that I could share them. And then I met Caroline Lawrence, who came to our school, an author trip. And I just went, oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Books are actually written by other people. That's a thing that can be done. And yeah, it kind of just went from there. And I think I completed my first full-length novel when I was 14. Yeah, and that was a proper long one, proper finished one.
That's insane. Mind you, I wrote a trilogy about the same age, and it's dreadful. This is a theme with my early writings. They're all dreadful. So no one will ever see them.
I think that's the case for most people.
Yeah. Although part of me, because it was all sort of werewolves and stuff, but set in the 18th century, when that became popular, I was kind of like, I really wish that I'd known how to write then and sort of like got on with it, because it would have been dreadful, but it would have been quite profitable and dreadful. You know.
It's amazing. It's amazing what a difference time can make.
Yeah.
Because there's pieces of work that I look back on, not just from, you know, like 5 years ago, but from even less time. And I know that I can do better now. And of course, at the time, it was the pinnacle of my writing. I felt the strongest I'd ever felt with writing. I always feel the strongest I've ever felt with my writing. I'm always pushing myself to really do the max that I possibly can. And every time I'd finished a piece of work, I'd be so pleased. You know, I mean, not always. Sometimes I went, ugh, and, you know, buried it in the bottom of my drawer. But, you know, I was always content to be quite proud with what I'd done.
Yeah.
Because I put a lot of effort into it, and I thought, I'm allowed to feel proud about it. And, yeah, even stuff that I wrote a year ago, I look back and I say, my God, the difference is phenomenal. It's obvious.
It's
amazing, because you really don't realize how quickly and how much you progress when you write a lot. And that is what it's down to. Just writing continuously. And by the end of the book, you'll be a better writer than you were at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, well, it obviously depends how quickly you write. But yeah, if you start... If you start a book and it takes you several years to finish it, then you may find that you need to go back to the start again. And because the start,
absolutely. But even over a few months, I mean, if it takes you a year to write a book, you will, the end will be better than the beginning. And that's obviously not just because of you developing as a writer, but, you know, each book as you approach it is going to have a slightly different style, slightly different feel to it, which is what you want, because you want each book to be unique. And you kind of have to adapt around that, which probably is why book hangovers are a thing for writers.
Yeah, well, and for readers, but yeah, the whole book hangover thing is something I'm sort of trying to get over at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Having finished book four and edited it and sent it out into the world, and it's just a case of, you know, I'm trying to write another series into a completely different series, and I can't hit my stride with it yet because my head is still in unveiled.
Yeah.
And I know it will, you know, fade over time and it will move back, but partly it's because I've got short stories and things that I've got to finish, and I haven't really taken a break as well, which, you know, sometimes you actually do need to take a break for a few days or, you know, a bit longer.
Yeah.
But yeah, serious book hangover. As in, I've had book hangover from reading books before, as in where I've walked around for a few days afterwards just not knowing where I am. But this is different. Yeah. I wrote the book.
Yeah, no, I think most avid readers will have experienced a book hangover. I mean, you also get that, you know, with films and stuff like that as well. So, but it is, yeah, when you finish writing a series, and or especially a series, and you just get to the end, you're like, oh, I cannot function when it comes to anything else.
No.
So yeah, book hangovers for writers is a genuine thing. And I think it is because you spend so long getting into the flow of the world that inevitably, when you try and move on from that, your whole style has shifted. So yeah, book hangovers, absolutely a thing. Trying to get your head out of it when you've been so concerned. So when you've been shaped as a writer by the thing that you're writing.
Yeah, I think there's a big, that's something that perhaps isn't talked about as much, but it is true. If you are properly invested in what you're writing, then it does shape you as a writer as well. It becomes a sort of symbiotic thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, looking at the more physical side of our writer's journey, or rather going back to where we first started either sharing our work or experiencing some success, which happened a bit earlier for you because you didn't waste like 20 years like hiding it from everyone. So
no, but I am a bit of a, what's the word, I'm not an extrovert, but like I do like people praising me.
I really like
to be praised and validated, okay? and there was no one that I loved being praised and validated more by than my parents, obviously. I wanted them to think I was amazing. So I think I probably started sharing stuff with them. I remember we used to have these talent shows when I was at school, and this was when I was 8 and 9 and then 10. We would have these talent shows in the dorm houses, and every talent show, they would always end with me telling a story, and I'd be continuing the story that I'd started the last time.
Huh.
And it would just be off the top of my head because I'd never written anything down. But it always happened, and then people said it was very relaxing. So I loved telling stories from a young age, and I loved sharing them. And it wasn't really actually to do with wanting praise when I shared it with other people. It wasn't that I wanted to be told, oh, that's an amazing story. I knew it was an amazing story. Not because I'm being conceited and saying I'm an amazing writer. This was before anything had been written down. It was an amazing story because I thought it was amazing because I was enjoying it. And I wouldn't share anything that I didn't really, really enjoy. And what I wanted was other people to kind of join in and provide into the story as well, to continue the story. It was like, this is a concept. Now help me tell the rest of it because I want to know what it is for myself. You know?
Yeah.
So we would, in groups, we tell these stories, and we do it every time. It was one of the main things I did with my friends, was that we'd create it was like informal D&D, not Dissecting Dragons, Dungeons and Dragons. Thank you. I'm a terrible human being. But that's what it was. It was kind of like a sort of a role player game. And I think that, yeah, I was just always more open with sharing my work, because not because I necessarily wanted praise from other people, but because I wanted to share the world, because I thought it was so marvelous and I spent so much time on it. And I wanted other people to help me expand the world. And that just kind of went on, where I wasn't really afraid to show people my work anymore. Until, of course, I started writing it down, and then I was a little bit more afraid because I was a terrible, terrible writer.
That's the thing.
You, on the other hand.
Yeah, me, on the other hand, didn't generally like to share stuff I'd written unless there was a specific purpose to it. For example, I will probably never, ever share any poetry I've written with anyone, because poetry can be quite personal. But when my gran died, I wrote a poem and ended up reading it in church, which, you know, you couldn't pay me to do under normal circumstances, but there was a good reason. So, you know, the good reason subsumes any concern to the ego, in my case. But, yeah, and I decided I actually would quite like to write properly, as in write actual books, and, you know, other people read them. And that means you have to get over the whole "I don't want people to look at my work" thing.
Yeah,
I'm not entirely over it. I'm nervous every time I send a book to, say, a beta reader or to my editor. My editor,
I think that's
can't
natural.
Quite get his head around this, but
I do think that's natural, because actually, as I've gotten older and as I've turned to storytelling in a more serious capacity, where it isn't just for fun anymore. I do get very, very nervous about sending work to you and to Amelia and other people, and then publishing it, because oh god, other people are going to read it now. But I think it's because there is more what's the word? I can't use my words today. There's more pressure on you if it's something that matters to you. So, for instance, I never get nervous about the fan fiction I write for you guys. Because what are you going to do? Nothing, okay? If it's terrible, what's going to happen? Absolutely nothing, okay? You're the only ones reading it. It's fan fiction. No one is expecting me to write anything incredible. But if you're publishing something, if you are sending it out in an official capacity, there is an expectation. You are going to be held up against other people, other people's books and stuff like that. And I think probably that's what marked you when you were young, because you were showing this stuff to a household of readers, and you yourself were a reader, an avid reader. So you were probably, when you were writing things from the beginning, you were already holding it up against these other published works within the same kind of capacity, within the same, it needs to be as good as this, this is what I'm competing against. Whereas I, of course, no such qualms. I was not comparing it to any book, because it didn't even occur to me that stories and books were the same kind of thing. I know it's daft, and like, of course I knew, but it didn't really occur to me, if that makes sense.
So
I wasn't held back in the same way, and I've become a lot more nervous about sending my work out now to people than I ever was when I was little.
Yeah, well, I mean, that does sort of make sense. It's how you come, it's how you get on the path to writing as well. I think it's fascinating that you've more or less come from a fan fiction route, in the sense of what you wrote originally was a take on something that you'd read that had inspired you. And in my case, it was very much a case of, no, I want to write this story, and it might be similar to other things, but it wasn't inspired by any one particular thing.
Yeah.
So
did come from.
I just think it's really interesting that we've sort of done that.
It was very much for me. It was a fan fiction route because I just wanted more. I'd watch something, I'd read something, and I'd want more. I'd want to tell my own version of it. And over time, I think you had an advantage over me as well because you had even more access to stories than I did. And I think that as writers, we are obviously influenced a lot by the media that we have around us and by the world. You know, every story draws its roots from our experiences. And for me, I was very limited to what I could watch, which I wasn't watching very much. It wasn't like I was watching things of extreme intelligence or anything like that. It was children's TV, you know.
Yeah.
I wasn't really watching anything mentally provoking. Whereas you were reading, you were an advanced reader from a very young age, and you were introduced to a lot more ideas, a lot more, a more diverse world in some ways that probably kind of developed your brain to allow you to create original content much sooner than I did. Because even though I had some wild and incredible experiences, the creative part of my brain was only developed through very limited media.
Yeah, no, I think that does make some sense as well. And I'd go through my own books really quickly. Mm-hmm. Okay, as an example, whenever we went on a holiday, Mum would buy us a book each, and then she would take the books back, as in she would take them away from us because she knew I could not be trusted with a new book, and I'd get it on the first day of the holiday. She knew damn well it wasn't going to last the entire week. It was literally going to last probably 2 days maximum. But I could not be trusted not to read a new book. So it was a case of, no, you can choose one, but then you can't have it until we actually get there. Which was sort of kind of a cruel thing, but, you know, she had reason because I would swear blind that I wasn't going to read it. And then I'd read it. You know, I had no self-control in that respect at all.
Unbelievable.
When I got to about nine, it was nine actually, and I think I was sloping around the house one wet Sunday because if I couldn't be reading, I liked to be outside playing football or hanging out with my best friend who was a lad who lived across the road. We were both a bit peculiar, to be fair. His dad's like, well, what's the matter with you? I've got nothing to read, I've read everything. So he handed me The Hobbit and I read that. And I was like, is there any more? So he handed me Lord of the Rings, which took me a little bit longer than The Hobbit. And I got through that. So then he started me on things like The Belgariad. So I read a lot of adult fantasy very early on. I mean, Dad obviously vetted it to check sexual content early. Violence was fine, but no sex kind of thing. I read, as you say, quite advanced early on. And then Mum got in on it with sort of, well, I think you should read some of the classics as well. So I was reading things like Dickens and Victor Hugo and Austen at 9 or 10 years old. So I was comparing what I was writing to them, which wasn't so great.
Jesus, yeah. It's... yeah, very different literary history for us.
Yeah, very much so. But I think the other thing was there was a kind of, someone else's worlds and characters were sacrosanct and you must not touch them kind of thing. So the most I would do is I would draw pictures or paint characters that I particularly liked. I read all of the Brian Jack Mossflower books or Red Wall books and I loved them. But again, it was a case of it wouldn't have occurred to me to sort of write fan fiction because, you know, you don't touch something like that. It's holy. To that person, and
you don't agree with
respectful.
You don't agree with Roland Barthes then killing the author.
Well, not at 9 years old. Admittedly, I hadn't come across him at 9 years old. But I don't know where I quite imbibed that from. But it was kind of, I think it was almost taking in every single day. You know, I grew up in this family of avid readers in a house literally full of books, and I had loads of books. Books were like the most, almost the most sacred things you can have. And bearing in mind, I was brought up Roman Catholic. that was like, that's really saying something. So, yeah, I that's why I think I was a bit late to understanding the whole fan fiction thing, because it was a case of, oh, don't do that, because that's wrong kind of thing. So, yeah, it's interesting. But I think it, learning to manipulate someone else's characters actually gives you a better idea of how to treat your own. So I missed out in that respect.
Yeah. I'd say it is interesting. I think there's just so many different ways that you can come to stories. And I think that all kids grow up telling their own stories.
Yeah.
That kid once, I still am, who imagined saving the day. What if ninjas burst out through the window and attacked everyone, but I secretly knew Kung Fu and was able to defeat the ninjas? You know, all kids do that. Calvin and Hobbes gets it down to a point where Calvin is always, you know, imagining that he's a space explorer or something like that. We all did that. My God, the amount of times that I got up onto the swing and imagined it was some futuristic hoverboard and that I was dashing through a portal of some kind. We just all do it. It's inevitable. But there's a difference between kind of the play stories that you put together and then a coherent story, okay?
Yeah.
And you can imagine all these amazing scenes, these battles, but then putting them down into a plot is where the difference comes. And the first, you know, the first moment that you get a coherent plot. And I think the first time I had a coherent plot for a story was a trilogy I started writing and never finished, inevitably, when I was about 9, 10. Based on all of the games that I've been playing with my kid, with my kids. Yes, at 9 and 10, I had other children with my friends. I tried to say with the other kids and with my friends at the same time, and it just didn't turn out well, okay? with my friends. And it was influenced by, you know, the things that were coming out at the time, which were sort of expanding my view of how the world could work and how fantasy could be so much bigger, because I'd been so limited in what I'd been able to see and what I, you know, I sort of gobbled up as a kid. So, yeah, it's amazing that when you start channeling those small ideas into a plot, and I feel like you got to the writing plots a lot quicker than I did.
Yeah, and you can blame that on the excessive reading, because that was a case of I did not want, you know, I got bored. I look at picture books now as a librarian and I see how necessary they are. And yet I don't remember having a lot of picture books. I know I had a couple, but I think I got bored of them quite quickly. And I particularly got bored of the ones without, the ones that generally don't really have a plot, because some of them just don't. So I clearly went on about, to, as you say, to the plot and needing more really, really early on. And also, I used to read to my sisters, and I used to read to the sister who was only 13 months younger than me, so it was something I did very, very early on. I think I've said before, I can't actually remember learning to read.
You just you were born with a book in your hand.
Well, I'm sure my mother would.
Congratulations,
have that.
Mr. and Mrs. Ironside. It's a librarian.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. No, I'm sure my mum would have mentioned if I'd come out with, you know, a leather-bound copy of Shakespeare or something. That would have made the occasion even more memorable. Bearing in mind that I chose to be born during Dorchester Carnival, and a load of people who my mum worked with at the hospital all went out in costume and then all popped back into the hospital in costume to see if I'd turned up yet. My mother was lying there in bed in labour going, I don't think I've been given any drugs, but what are the clowns everywhere?
My idea of a nightmare.
Yeah, pretty much. So apologies to to my mother if you ever hear this. No, I didn't come out with the book, but I think I must have just started picking up so early on that I genuinely don't remember the originally learning.
Yeah.
And then, of course, my parents, oh no, actually, mostly it's just my mum. My mum complained that I always had my nose in a book. It's like, well, you started this.
Like, there's literally worse things. It's like, I love it, because a few years later, everyone's like, oh, you're always on your computer. Why can't you read a book? You know, it's just always one thing. People are always just complaining about kids. Oh, you're outside too much. You're too messy. Or, oh, you're inside the house too much. We just love to complain. Anyone younger than us is doing it wrong. This is a fact known by everybody.
That was it. It was either you've always got your nose in a book, or you've always got muddy knees and messy hair. It's like, well, yeah, I was outside playing football and now I'm inside reading a book. And I'm actually not doing anything wrong. I'm just keeping to myself.
What do you want from me? Just to do the dishes constantly. Anyway, so that moment of developing into a coherent plot. So when did you finish writing I Belong to the Earth?
Oh, I finished writing that in February 2014. And I wrote it in 3.5 weeks.
I hate you.
However, I then rewrote it 12 times.
Yeah.
Because I needed to. It was my I had written things before, but it was my first real book. And it needed, I wouldn't say the plot changed massively. It didn't. I don't know. I think I'd been sort of planning it in my head for a couple of years without even thinking that I was going to set it down on paper.
Yeah.
But it needed rewriting, and each time things got smoothed out. And I look at it now and I think, it's not bad, but there are clunky bits that I'd definitely do differently if I was sitting down to write that today. But that's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it was published 25th of April 2015. I looked up these dates. My memory's not actually this good. So really that was pretty quick. Concept to writing it, to rewriting it, to getting it published.
You know, I actually have the email in front of me, the email that I sent you on the 3rd of April 2015.
Aww.
I was replying to the review you left of The Sons of Thestium.
Yeah.
Yes, I very much look forward to the release of your book, so please do keep me posted on its progress. Do you have a Facebook page which I can follow? And yeah, I have our first correspondence. It makes me very nostalgic.
It's making me very nostalgic. And it's like, it's weirdly, it seems like no time at all, but it also seems like years ago. And it is years ago, but I mean, even more years ago.
Yeah, I just love reading it because we're so formal with each other.
Yes, we are. We've gone really British, haven't we? And just gone, you know, aside from not putting the addresses at the top in the correct layout and
yeah.
Date user type thing. We are pretty much formal letter writing.
I'm just looking through them. We were so formal and we were really being very polite with one another, and we wrote these incredibly long, I say incredibly long. The emails we would send each other got longer and longer. I'm just scrolling up now, and they're just getting just lengthening every time.
Yeah,
but it was amazing. What a difference it made.
It was right up to you. You said, you know, we could just chat on Facebook. I'm like, yeah, okay, let's try.
Yeah, we sort of went, let's be friends on Facebook. and yeah, the emails stopped. They were all over Goodreads as well. The Goodreads email stopped. I mean, it's amazing. But I look back at it and I think of who I was then and who I am now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've said this before, and I don't mind saying it again. knowing you, the relationship we've had has made me a better writer. Simple as.
Yeah.
I think it's also made me a better person, but
I can't take that much credit. No, I would say the same actually for me, because it is really important as a writer that you have people you can obviously show your work to and talk to as kind of a professional exchange, I guess. Like, if you were a doctor or something, you'd have conversations with colleagues, wouldn't you? And it's the same if you're a writer.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So there's that, and yes, it has made me a better writer. I think being a writer has changed who I am as a person as well.
Yes, I agree. I think that is the case. I mean, there's this thing, and I always talk to my students about how we're, I've probably mentioned this before as well, how we're intimidated by other writers because we see them as competition. I really encourage now my students not to do that, because I know that I did, and I know that a lot of people waste so much time being intimidated, being nervous around other writers, not wanting to share your work. And, you know, there's this fear, what if they steal my work? And okay, that could happen. You know, I wouldn't share my work with someone I just met, you know.
Yeah.
Forming bonds with other writers who are in the same position as you is one of the most invaluable things you can do. And if you are a creative, the worst thing you can do is shut yourself out from the creative world. Get to know other people who work within your capacity and who work just outside of it as well. So get to know people who write short stories or poems or songs even. Because actually, the way that you discuss things, even if you're not talking about your work specifically, will improve your writing. It always will. Because the sharing of ideas is so phenomenal when it comes to engaging your creative brain. And so it's a shame, because I was at university, obviously, when I met Jules, and I was doing creative writing. So I did have this nice sort of cohort of people who I'd share my work with. But this was at a time that I was still kind of very, not dismissive. Dismissive's not the right word, because I appreciated and I really liked workshopping with them. And there are several, you know, Amelia and co, who I still work with today. And that was fantastic. But I was still bound by this very slight fear that meant that I wasn't really engaging with them on the level that I could have been. And it really began with Jules, because we just got talking. And I loved the discussions we had, even if they had nothing to do with books. I really loved the discussions we had. I loved listening to your point of view, because we didn't always agree.
Yeah.
And I found my work developing because of it.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think, obviously, coming from slightly different backgrounds and different age groups as well.
Yeah, I think so. That's definitely true.
We had enough there that formed a basis for commonality, but at the same time, and we were obviously writing similar genres.
Yeah, which helps.
Which definitely does help. but we weren't direct competition, so we never went in thinking, oh, you're competition kind of thing, I think.
No, I think that's what made the difference, is that we were approaching each other because we were both obviously, we were under the same umbrella. And so it wasn't your competition. It was, we can work together. We're comrades. We're in the same boat. And I think that was really what switched that switch in my brain that suddenly went, oh, wait, oh, my God, other writers are my friends. I can do this. And because of that, I have now got this team, and I know Jules does as well, of excellent secondary readers and beta readers and editors and people who will be critical and honest and who will listen to your ideas. And it just makes you a better writer every single day. It really does.
Yeah. I mean, you have people like J.D. Salinger, who wrote The Catcher in the Rye, and he wrote it in complete isolation without any feedback. But you notice he only ever did it once. And there are others as well who've done the same thing. I don't think you can create really effective, accessible art in isolation.
Yeah. And you know, feel free to prove us wrong. Yeah. Be the exception that proves the rule if you like. But I think it's also a more enjoyable experience if you go out and connect with other people. I also think that it allows it to be more sustainable, because you might be able to write one or maybe even two excellent books or songs in total isolation. But if you don't go out there, you're not going to be able to continue doing that. You have to nurture your brain.
One of the big things Madeline did for me was get me to have fun with what I was doing, which sounds insane. No, it really does. But obviously I was writing because I enjoyed it, but it wasn't so much that I was taking myself too seriously, but I think I was taking the process too seriously. And I was forgetting that it was okay to be a bit silly with it sometimes. It was okay to have fun with it. I wasn't producing the next great English novel. I wasn't even trying to in the first place. But somewhere along the line, there was too much invested in it in a serious way rather than just sort of, this is fun, this is what I like to do.
Yeah.
And it makes a really big difference, because if you're writing something and you're having fun while you're doing it, that comes out in your writing and your readers respond to that.
Yeah. If you hate writing something.
If you hate what you're writing, that will come out in your writing and your readers will notice it. Conversely,
yes, they will.
So anyway, the first episode of Dissecting Dragons was broadcast on the 11th of February 2016, which
do
is
you
believe
build
it or not
a snowman.
Yeah, this is my one do you want to build a snowman thing, and since then Madeline has hit me with any number of snowmen incidents. But that's almost 2 years ago. So 100 episodes. We just said, well, we'll do two a month initially, didn't we?
We did. Yeah, we said we'll release one a fortnight.
And then after the first one, we said, well, I think we should do it once a week. But okay, well, we'll do once a week then. And we haven't looked back. So yeah, it's amazing, really.
It is. It is amazing. The size of it kind of boggles the mind. It really does. Because that's 100 hours that we've spent talking about speculative fiction.
Yeah.
And I still feel like we've barely scratched the surface.
I know, right? We think we could talk 1,000 hours. This is only 100 recorded hours. This is nothing to all the little chats we've had in between about what we should talk about. And,
yeah. You know, we've had discussions and we'd be like, oh, we should talk about this in Dissecting Dragons.
Yeah. It's mad. And then you have to think how far we've actually come, both, you know, physically as writers, but also within things like technique. Because I suppose, yeah, my first book had been out for not even a year when the first episode of this dropped. And yeah. I think yours had been out for just about a year. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
We were still with our previous publisher at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was struggling so hard with book two at that point in time as well. I was really, really struggling with it. No, I just finished it, I think. But I wasn't quite happy with it. So there was loads, there's been so much that I've done since. There really has.
Yeah, the books have just been pouring out of you. And the novellas.
Well, I mean, okay, yeah, there's been, I think, five novellas. Admittedly, only three are available at the moment. There's been short stories of various different things. There's been three more novels in that series. There's been
and an
a
accidental
historical duology. And an accidental one, yeah, good boy. And then I've crammed two other full series since then. So sometimes it's good to look back, because you can only see how far you've come once you've got to a point and you look back.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
I mean, I wouldn't say that the writing process itself has got easier for me, but the thing is, I suppose when I get into the car that is writing, I kind of know where I need to go now, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think it'll always be a challenge, so long as you're trying to get better, so.
Yeah. Yeah, it should challenge you. It should be a bit of a push each time. Each book is different. Each book is difficult in its own way.
I'm still, my mind is still a little bit blown just about looking back. It's like walking up a mountain.
Yeah.
And you've been walking and you feel like you're not getting anywhere, but you feel like, oh God, the top just doesn't seem to be any closer. And then you stop and you look back down and you realize just how far you've come.
Yeah.
We really have come very, very far in a very small amount of time.
Yeah, we have. One of the big discoveries for me, I think, is that in order to have some sort of peace of mind, if you're going to do writing as a career, is that you need to redefine success and failure for yourself.
Yeah.
And the one thing you need to do with failure is you need to take it on board as it's a learning experience. You know, failure isn't the be-all and end-all. I think we're indoctrinated too early on in life, certainly I was, that failure is bad and it is to be avoided at all costs. And actually, no, failure is one of your best teachers.
Yeah.
So it's not, you shouldn't set out to fail, but if you do fail, it should be taken with, you know, it should be appreciated proportionately. So it should be a case of, okay, well, that, I failed, but I'm not going to beat myself up for 6 months over. I'm not going to throw everything away. I'm not going to say, well, I can't write. Because that's not what it's about. It's a case of, well, that one didn't pan out, but I can learn from it.
Yeah.
You become a much better person, a much better writer that way. And I suppose the other point is that as little successes you think you have, there are people lower down on the mountain, to use Madeline's metaphor, than you, who are looking up to you and envying you your success. I don't think that really hit me until quite recently.
Yeah. Yeah,
so while
absolutely.
While you're looking up at the really big sellers and things, there are people below you looking up at you and thinking, oh God, I wish I was published. I wish I could finish a novel.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the other important thing that comes along with that realization that failure is not something bad, but it's another step that you can use to get higher, is coming to realize that the thing that you are investing in isn't any one book or project. And I think we can get very disheartened. You know, the first book I wrote, it's never going to see the light of day. It's terrible. But it was the first novel I wrote, and I sort of, when I was far too young, I tried to sort of ship it out to agents, see if anyone was interested, and you know, obviously I didn't get any bites, but I cared about it a lot. And now I look at what I'm doing, and it made such a difference when I finally understood that I can always love the books that I'm working on. I can always, always love them. But I am not limited to them. I'm not a one-trick pony. I'm every time I start a new series, it's going to be better. The series I'm writing after The Sons of Thestian is better than the Hamartia cycle ever was. I'm going to say it. I'm a better writer now than I was before, and I understand that each piece of fiction has a place in my story as a writer, and that actually that's okay. And the book that will never see the light of day, I needed to write that book. I needed to, because if I hadn't, I'd have never been able to write The Sons of Thestian.
Yeah, it's absolutely not wasted. I mean, even the really, really crap stuff I wrote very early on, all the things that I started writing when I thought I needed to be a literary writer and I was trying to write in a literary vein, and I just sounded like a pretentious ass the entire time. That's all things you have to do on the way. You have to learn. Ultimately, I could probably write something that is a bit more literary now because I've learned how to write, but I'm not a literary writer. I'm a genre writer. And you know what? I'm happy with that because I didn't enjoy writing literary fiction.
Yeah.
And I think that's another thing. Don't write what you think you ought to write. Write what you love.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Because writing is a hard and lonely path at times. If you're also doing something that you don't enjoy, then yeah, it's just another weight to add to your back. Don't do it to yourself.
Also, yes, you absolutely can make a living writing. I'm not yet. I'm supplementing for a living. But I have plans for the future. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's not selling out. Wanting to be paid for your art is not selling out. On the other hand, writing is not a get-rich-quick scheme. There are much, much easier ways of making lots of money than writing. So, because writing's really hard work, and B, selling your writing's pretty hard work as well.
Yes.
So, yeah, it has to be something that you do either because you love it or because you're just compelled to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. What a journey. Sorry, I sound really kind of, what a journey.
Okay, so as we reach the end of this celebratory episode, what would your top bits of advice be for any aspiring writer listening?
Keep writing. Oh, that sounds so lame, and everyone always says it, but it really is the best piece of advice. Just keep writing. Finish one book, and if it's the one you kind of feel very close to it, edit it, but don't abandon other ideas. Don't put them on the wayside. Just keep creating new content, and you will find that you get better and better. And involve yourself within that community. Get a few close people who you can trust, who you enjoy speaking to. Who don't necessarily always agree with you, who are critically minded, and share your ideas and share your work with them. And I think the last bit is just enjoy yourself. Make sure you're informed, make sure you know what's happening, keep your finger on the temple, but make sure that you're enjoying yourself. Because, as I said, it's such a lonely and difficult path to write that you have to give yourself that light. And if the light isn't there, take a step back and ask yourself why.
Yeah, absolutely. I would add to that the fact that, yeah, ultimately, I just reiterate, don't compare yourself to anybody else, because overnight successes don't actually happen overnight. We're presented that because it's a story that people want to hear, but it's actually not true. That's not what happens.
No.
What happens is we're not shared the years of struggling in ignominy that many writers go through before something hits it big. And, you know, there are writers who never really hit it big, but they're comfortable at a mid-level. So if you're thinking in practical terms of earning a living, it's perfectly possible to do that without being, say, Stephen King.
Yeah.
And we've already got a Stephen King, so we don't need another one.
No.
Which is the other thing to consider. On the other hand, what the world doesn't have is you. You know, you're writing, so always be you, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yes, I agree. Always be you. Find your voice. And just keep at it. For
and
the
read
love
lots.
Of God. Read lots, yeah. Open yourself up to content.
The other thing I would say is learn, well, you could probably get an entire episode out of this, but learn to take critique and learn to give it, because she who critiques learns twice in this respect. So reading I've heard writers say, I just don't have time to beta read people. I'm like, well, that's stupid, because actually when you beta read, you're improving your own writing by default. So find time. I mean, obviously don't beta read in genres that you really hate. I wouldn't beta read somebody's romance novel because I'd be useless.
Yeah.
But I've learned a lot more about writing probably from critiquing other people's work than I have from actually sitting and writing. I've learned a lot from that.
Yeah. We can do an entire episode on reading as a writer as well. I think we've done an episode on reading as a writer.
We could probably revisit it.
We could do another episode on reading as a writer, and what that can entail. But yeah, that's the dragon's advice to you guys, you creative people out there. Just keep going. We believe in you, and we'll see you at the top of the mountain or halfway up it, if you like.
Yeah, find yourself a writing buddy who gets you to do some slightly crazy stuff, whether that's starting a podcast, delving into fan fiction when you wouldn't normally touch it, or I don't know, there's a host of other things.
Yeah, the things I've made you do. Dress up, become an Irish witch. That's my party. I mean, you're already an Irish witch, so it wasn't hard.
Yeah, typecasting.
Yeah, we've had a few insane ideas. They've all worked so far. So yeah, thank you once again, everybody, for sticking with us, for being there with us on our journey. We hope that we've inspired you as much as you've supported us. And here's to another 100 episodes, if we can.
Yeah, here's to another 100 episodes.
Congratulations, Jules.
Congratulations, Madeline.
And on that note, we'll say goodbye.
Thanks and goodbye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.